Welcome to the Duluth Rundown, episode 45. Before we get started with our interview with Dan Proctor, a quick message regarding our sponsor for the episode, Austin Jaro. Austin Jaro is a running store here in Duluth. They just moved their location. It's bigger, very spacious. They have everything that you need for running. It's really close to their old location up by the mall. Thanks for sponsoring this episode. Go check out Austin Jaro.
All right, everyone. We are ready with our interview portion of the podcast. Joined here with, Mike and I are joined here with our guest, Mr. Dan Proctor. I think everybody who's listening right now probably knows Dan-o from, I don't know how many ever years back. But Dan, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Well, hi, guys.
It's really good to have you. I'm super happy to have you on the podcast. Been meaning to get in touch with you about this for a long time, and serendipitously ran into you in the grocery store parking lot the other day, and I'm like, opportunity knocks. I'm going to talk to him right now.
So. That's life in Duluth. That's how you run into people, and it happens.
That is exactly.
Yeah. It's like the people that do know me from running, they know me because I'm behind them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about running, Dan. Let's talk about a little bit around running in Duluth. When did you get started running, and was it even in Duluth? Have you always been here?
Well, the story of Duluth would start in actually 79 when I was still living in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
And I did my first grandma's marathon, which was grandma's third year at that time. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the decision to move up to Duluth, was that, wow, what a great running community. You'd come up and people were running all during the day on the roads. And it's like, so, wow.
Just real quick to interrupt, I'm sorry, you were in your 20s at this time?
29.
Okay. Yeah. So end of the 20s. Okay.
Yeah. And, I grew up down in the suburbs, and in the suburbs, you know, people, some running was going on, but fortunately I did grow up in the western suburb of Hopkins, where they did have a very good cross-country program. Coach Noreen had a whole bunch of state high school champions coming out of there, and we had a summertime run every year, the Raspberry Parade.
Okay.
And it was a 5-miler that went right by my house, and of course, hey, might as well do this. And I found out I could run. I've always been able to motivate and move using my own energy. Mm-hmm. And at that time too, I was starting to get disillusioned with having a car. And that was another reason why I decided to move to Duluth, is it's a pedestrian city. So when I moved to Duluth, I got rid of my car.
Okay.
And when that happens, you walk a lot or you run. For a while, I had a job up by the mall, and I was initially living out by French River, and I'd run into work.
Wow. French and River along the shore, along or French shore. River up the up away
along the shore. Yeah,
like a 10-mile run in.
Yeah. And usually I could beg a ride home or something, or I'd ride a bike. You know, and well, even when I was living in the cities, I would commute to work. At one time, I had an 18-mile one-way commute to the work, man. And this is before the cities had all their bike lanes.
Yeah,
but I guess the realization that automobiles were changing the world in a way I didn't really want to go along with. Mm-hmm. And I figured that the only way to change something like that is to change myself. I can't ask anyone else to change.
Sure.
I can only change myself. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it'll have a positive effect. Again, that's, you know, moving up to Duluth. Okay, 81, moved up to Duluth, bought a house with my friend Gary Larson out in Lakeside. And Gary was at that time the UMD cross country ski coach. Mm-hmm. And he went on to be the assistant coaches for the U.S. Olympic team for cross country skiing. Mm-hmm. And it was great. We lived out in the Lakeside. I started getting into running, and we had this big house, and we said, hey, we have an extra room. Who should we rent it to? Well, we ended up renting it to a number of people. One of the people was Jaro.
Okay.
And Jaro at that time was 18 years old. Uh-huh. And he had just basically finished a year of college in England. Mm-hmm. And he was real excited about this wonderful race that he's putting on. The first annual, which ran for 10 years, the first annual Skyline 25K, mm-hmm. which started way out by Beck's Road and on Skyline Drive and ended up at Chester Park. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, that's basically one of the first runs in Duluth besides Grandma's. I got real excited. Mm-hmm. Then he said, "Hey, in the fall, let's have a cross country runs on some of these other places where we've been training all the time." Mm. So that was the start of the cross country series. I think that was about 81 or 82, 83, I think, is when the fall cross country series. And then of course that was such a great idea.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, why don't we do this in the spring too?"
Right.
So Jaro said, "Okay, you set up the races," and we ended up doing the races. They were initially on all of the cross-country ski trails in Duluth.
Yeah.
As, I mean, the conditions were, you know, melting. There was no skiing on them. There was no snow, basically, on the trails.
Right.
Some of them were muddy, you know, that's a given. And it was basically with the idea of trying to get the runners to know of these wonderful trails that a lot of them didn't even know about.
Sure.
Because they didn't ski. So, you know, it was basically a showing off of our assets here.
Sure.
And it's you got to be careful what you show off, because pretty soon it starts getting popular. Right. Well, it took a few years to get popular.
Yeah.
Our initial races were 20 to 25 people. Mm-hmm. Horrible conditions. I mean, we ran everything, but with, you know, 25 runners, you're not going to do too much trail damage.
Right.
And now, of course, they're up above 100, just about every one of them. And,
at least.
It's good to see, yeah.
Yeah.
And the beauty part about it, too, is that it's not as competitive as it really some people would like, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets people out. And, again, just the whole idea of getting you to a different place than you're used to running.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, and of course it's gotten to more than just the ski trails. And
right,
again, we've got so many runners that we have to watch the conditions now.
Right.
So again, it's part of growing up, learning the responsibilities of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was still 25 people, it wouldn't really be an issue, right? It's just a
It's a group workout.
Yeah.
And,
in terms of the damage to the trails per se, right? So.
Right.
You have to start thinking about that after 100 people or 200 people.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And in 82, I think that was the second Voyager 50 miler.
Yeah.
I hopped on my bike and I rode out just to spectate. Okay, so spectate and watch what was going on. And it was so exciting that the next year I basically volunteered. And at that time, Bill Austin and Jaro were in over their head, and he says, "Okay, you're race director." So I was race director for about 3 years for the Voyager, and I think we had 65 runners for the first year that I directed it.
Yeah.
And we kind of said, "Well, we should never have more than 125 runners on this trail, because it's just too much, you know."
Yeah,
and especially being an out and back. To get some congestion that way too.
Right. And again the aid stations, I mean it's quite a feat to get those things stocked. My God. I mean it used to be, you know, you basically had water there and a couple crackers maybe. And for some reason canned boiled potatoes. But it somehow,
with some salt.
Yeah, with some salt. It hits the spot. It gives you potassium and doesn't upset the stomach. And that was kind of that, you know, got into the Voyager. And for a number of years, the Voyager was precarious. We were, you know, running into all sorts of obstacles with the permitting agency, mm-hmm. particularly with the city. Mm-hmm. And we went to the Carlton Lions Club meeting one day and presented our case and said, "Oh, that's a great idea. Why don't you tie in with our Carlton Days Festival?" And I said, "Well, okay, fine." And then we got to get insurance. It's, "Oh, well, our insurance will cover you."
Wow.
Nice.
So they covered our insurance, which at that time was, you know, starting to get expensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the insurance is such a funny thing. You just don't buy insurance for one race, or at least you didn't then.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That insurance covered all of our cross-country series for the whole year.
Interesting. Wow.
What a deal.
Yeah.
So, and since then, too, if you look at the history or the lack of history of injuries on both the Voyager and the cross-country series, we've had minor injuries, but they've been things like slip and fall and, you know, cut your knee, nothing, you know, broken leg or, you know, anything like that.
Right.
You know, and again, thank the Lord that, I mean, it hasn't been serious, but I think it's the activity that, you know, we basically ask people to be responsible.
Yeah.
So that's that was that. Well, then again, I continued to run up till about 2 years ago, and now I'm getting so old and rickety that my body doesn't need the impact.
Yeah.
But I walk a lot, and I ride my bike a lot. And I occasionally cross-country ski. So, I mean, I'm not totally hanging it up, but I just don't need the impact anymore.
Still plenty active, though.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's good.
So, back then in Hopkins, I mean, were you on the cross-country team, or was it literally the Raspberry Run, and you just saw the race course and said, hey, I should do this? Or what got you initially into it?
Well, I don't know. I guess the thing was is from an early age, I've always had a job. I've had to work.
Yeah.
I had paper routes. I worked in restaurants. I worked at Red Owl stores for a number of years. I could not go out for a team.
Sure.
I tried a little bit, and it just, you know.
From a time management perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the coaches says, if you're not here every day, you're not going to participate. Yeah. Well, sorry, you know. And
sure.
And fortunately, we had a really interesting junior high school Phi Ed teacher, name of Mr. Elmer Luke. And in the summertime, he was the lifeguard at the local beach.
Sure.
And he was also the track coach.
Okay.
And of course, he approached me and said, yeah, you should come out and run with us and stuff like that. I said, well, I've got my paper out and I really can't do it. But in the summer, of course, he saw me swimming. He knew I was a good swimmer. And he says, well, just keep doing what you're doing, stay active.
Yeah.
And you don't have to compete, just participate.
Sure.
And this is what the whole sports is basically built around the middle. There's one winner and everyone else is participants, but those participants are winning too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, if it's a battle to be number one or to battle it out on the top, people start taking shortcuts that aren't honest. And that's something that if you got to lie about what you're doing, then you should probably stop doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, again, I was fortunate. Again, I bopped into the 5 mile Raspberry Run. And
yeah.
Again, I was young at the time. I think the first one I did was I was probably 16.
Sure.
And I finished in the top 20.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, God, I how can I do this?
Yeah.
And then I would also at that time, I would walk to work. And walking to and from work was a 2.5 mile walk each way. So I was basically getting my mileage in.
Every day.
Every day. Every day. And, you know, even now with not running officially, when I was working before I was retired, I did a pedometer.
Yeah.
And I was doing 25 miles a day on my feet every day. Mm-hmm. And then coming home and running.
That adds up.
So again, it really adds up. It's the base is there.
Right.
But again, it's low intensity. And the other weird thing, too, is I've never been injured where I had to pull out of a race.
Wow, yeah.
Or actually see medical help for overuse or anything. Knock on wood.
Yeah, yeah. Good. So how did the in-between between that first 5 mile Raspberry Run and Grandma's Marathon, which sparked your interest maybe in moving to Duluth, what happened there?
Well,
in between, how did you get to the marathon?
Well, again, it's there's always girls involved, and and I had a woman friend that was running and encouraged me, and That was part of it. And the other deal too is, as I said, I commuted to and from work 2.5 miles.
Yeah.
Well, why not run home from work? Why not run to work? Why not, when you ride your bike to work during lunchtime, hop on the bike and ride 10 miles and come back nice and sweaty for the afternoon? So, I mean, it was, work was also kind of a focus. And then in those days too, people used these really heavy hiking boots. And sometimes I'd run with his hiking boots. And, I mean, you get really great ankle support. But boy, what a workout.
Yeah.
You don't go fast, but again, it makes you better.
And sure.
Again, it's not all about speed. It's about finishing the race.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or finishing the run. So that's, yeah. And again, when I came up to Duluth, unfortunately, I met Jaro and a few other people, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tony and Mike, you guys didn't come along till a lot later.
A lot later, yeah, exactly.
But, you know, what a pleasure that we're constantly renewed with new energy in Duluth.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something we got to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. That's one of our kind of our themes with this podcast, is how we're all sort of a link in a chain. And, you know, Mike and I doing this podcast, hopefully we're inspiring some, hopefully there's some younger listeners, or, you know, that'll kind of take up this mantle or do something similar like you guys did with the NMTC for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys started something, and the North Shore Striders as well, you know, got things rolling. You two, those two groups for sure really kind of got things rolling in Duluth, and now it continues in slightly different ways. NMTC is still rolling, and we've got this, and then there's a couple other folks that are doing things. And
I think to, you know, get people involved, just like you mentioned, Dan, for me personally, NMTC was like exactly that. You know, I was a college student at UMD, just kind of enjoyed running, somehow heard about, I think it was probably you, Tony, at the Duluth Running Company store, who just said, like, check this out. And then you learn about all these trails, and it's amazing. It's like opening a whole new world, you know. So for me, that's how I got more involved, I think, just like
NMTC
that.
NMTC was for me as well when I moved here.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And so to hear that, that's how it kind of started. Now, Dan, let me ask you this. In the early days of NMTC, to what extent was it getting new people involved? You know, you said it was maybe 25, pretty low numbers comparatively, but...
It was a slow snowball. For a number of years, it was just barely getting off the ground. And since we did have a lot of younger people that, you know, were college age and just starting careers and starting families, a lot of them moved or had families. Mm-hmm. And either they came back, if we're lucky enough, or they got replaced by other people that were interested. With the trail situation in the early 80s too, the city had very little responsibility for the trails. The cross-country ski trails were groomed by the cross-country ski club until the ski club got burned out doing it, because everyone wanted perfect trails and no one wanted to do it except for the Boyd Christensen. And Boyd, bless his heart, went out and made sure we had really nice trails, but he never got to ski because he was burnt out from grooming the trails. The city had, you know, a wealth of hiking trails that had gone into decrepitude and disrepair. And in 1985, they wanted to close down Chester Creek Hiking Trail.
Wow.
Because they looked at it as a liability. It was washed out into the creek in about 5 places. And they said, oh, all people do is go down there and drink and do drugs. And I said, no, this is a transportation link between downtown and the colleges.
Right.
This is in people's backyard. This is why people are going to want to live in this neighborhood. And they begrudgingly said, well, okay, if you want to keep the trail going, I guess you can. You know? So I'm still doing that.
Yeah.
Is that how that started? Your maintenance in Chester is just, it was so decrepit.
Well, the trail was there. I mean, believe me, it was, the trail started in the official recognizance of it was 1895. Mm-hmm. And they've had fits and starts of attention to it. In the 30s, the WPA and the CCC did rock work and grade improvements. They have some beautiful pictures from that time of people down picnicking and so on in the park.
There's still some remnants of that. I believe in my neighborhood off of 6th Street, the steps down are the original CCC.
Yeah, actually, those go even farther. That was redone by the CCC.
Oh, sure.
End of the 60s. Wow. That used to be a graveyard between 4th and the walking bridge at, well, it's between 5th and 6th Street. Uh-huh. And that used to be a cemetery, and it reached all the way over to 13th on the other side. And the Jewish cemetery got moved up to Howard Gneisen Road in about 1916.
Oh, yeah.
So if you look out in the field, there's a couple big divots. Well, those were old graves that they dug out and they translocated. Huh. So that's... And the bridge, the bridges that were there, those were dropped in with in 1981 as replacements for old stone bridges that the National Guard in 1981 wanted to do a community service project. So they dropped in these bridges on a weekend. They did like 20 bridges in town with a helicopter dropping them in. Cool. This is what you can do when you have the National Guard stay home. Rebuilding your own country, not rebuilding someone else's country. And again, a wonderful help from them. We'll always be grateful. And hopefully we can have them back to work on the trails sometime again.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Wow, I have no idea.
I don't know if all of our listeners know that the sign off of Skyline where it says Dan Proctor Hiking Trail, that's you.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not the sign, but I'm definitely, be careful about people naming things after you, because then you have to really take care of them.
There's more responsibility. Right?
Yeah.
So it was, that was honestly a conversation in the early to mid 80s of, let's just ditch this Chester Creek Trail.
It's a liability.
It's too hard.
Yeah, we're going to get sued. Someone's going to hurt themselves. Wow. It's going to be a police problem.
So you kind of just said to yourself, like, I like the trail. I'm going to maintain it the best I can.
Yeah.
Or was there input from the city to...
Well, I did have kind of an inside track. I persuaded the city in 1984 to hire me as their trail maintainer. And we worked on...
For Chester only or for all the trails?
It started at Lester Park.
Okay.
And one of our first projects was to put the lights on the cross-country ski trail.
Were you still living out in Lakeside at the time then?
I was living out in Lakeside at the time, yep. And we put the lights out, and we also widened the trail, and we did culvert crossings for all the ski trail. The trail, and there's 65 culverts that we hauled in by hand because it was so muddy you could not bring a vehicle out without getting stuck.
Yeah.
And after we did the culvert work, then you could drive out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, again, it's just basic, you know, maintenance to keep wheeled vehicle damage down to a minimum, and particularly if it's a powered wheel vehicle.
Yeah.
And there were ruts. They had motorcycle ruts and stuff out there that were 3 feet deep.
Yeah.
And no way are you going to repair them without equipment. So we did have the bulldozer available for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to do the repairs. And again, since the drainage problems were taken care of, and with better signage, people got educated that they probably shouldn't go back there with their motorcycles and their and their all-wheel drives. And it's held up.
Yeah.
So that was part of that. And then, well, of course, with working with the city, we worked all the way out to Mission Creek Trail in Fond du Lac, which is another historic road/trail that was in bad shape. And we were able to bring that back into use, which was, of course, for the Voyager, that's indispensable.
Yeah.
And the Piedmont trails, we widened that and improved it. The Hartley Field ski trails, we widened and did drainage work there so that it's more usable. And you do your cross-country ski trail maintenance in the off-season. You don't wait until the last week like they're doing now. If you do it in the off-season, it sets up and it'll hold up.
Right. And it takes time.
It takes...
For things to set.
Yeah.
The ground has to settle and all that.
Yeah, yeah. So again, it's, you know, the maintenance you do in the off-season, ideally. But during the season, if you see damage, it doesn't hurt to go back the next day, if you have the time, with a shovel and touch things up. Mm-hmm. You do a little bit of drainage work and it'll pay off.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the weird thing is that, you know, I'm basically out modifying the public parks and, you know, cutting vegetation, which you're not supposed to do in a park. But the NMTC basically mowed Lester Park trails for the fall runs.
Yeah.
And then the other trails out west, we ended up mowing the trails so that they could be used in the all season long. And some of the trails weren't official trails, but people were using them. And, you know, why not, if you're going to use them, make it so that, okay, it's nice enough for them to concentrate their use on those rather than using all the other trails that aren't in such good shape.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a focusing. If you maintain something, if you make it attractive, if it invites you to use it, you will use the trail.
Right.
If you let it go to pieces, people are going to make their own trail someplace else, make everyone upset.
Yeah.
And it's poor condition and... unsightly. Does anyone know about the Duluth trail system better than you?
Oh yeah. again, this the Jaro's name keeps coming up just because again his dedication and his I guess, you know, you have to be kind of compulsive to keep records like Jaro does, and he's got a wonderful memory for the trails and who did what, when, where, and how. And I'm glad someone does, because for me it's like, hey, we just did it, you know, who cares if we did it last year or the year before, but let's do it again. And you know, it's you know, we all bring our own skills and our own personalities to what we do,
right?
And you know, I used to, you know, again, I used to take great pride when I put on the Chester Creek annual run. I would like to give an award for the middle place finisher.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't figure out where you're going to run in the middle of the pack until it's all over. You can't find that place. But if you do, that means if you ran a little faster, you'd be better than most. If you ran a little slower, well, you need to work more. Right. But it's that cutoff point. And again, it's that point where we need the middle.
Yeah.
Because without the middle, we have nothing to reference against.
Right.
And I think that kind of comes from science fiction. The Isaac Asimov series, his Foundation series, they talk about the ends of the universe. Mm-hmm. And the ends of the universe are not only way, way out there, but it's also from where you start.
Right.
And each place is equidistant on a circle. It's not...
Right.
It's not one way or the other, so... When you run out of trails, you're running out of circle. You always end up where you started. Doggone. Why didn't I get somewhere with this? Kind of like that analogy. It went nowhere.
Well, speaking of individual talents and personalities and record keeping, Dan, I've had the opportunity to read some of the old NMTC newsletters, which you contributed to back in the day quite a bit. And I say this absolutely lovingly, but you guys were an incredibly irreverent bunch of people.
Oh yeah.
They're a blast to read. They're really fun. Just goofballs.
What are they?
Newsletters. Just
newsletters.
Monthly newsletters?
Yeah, we tried to be monthly.
Yeah.
And they got mailed out to people?
Yeah, paper, mail. You remember those days?
Yeah, I'm not familiar. I mean,
they spent time on these things.
I've read about
them. There's pictures, and then there's early versions of Photoshop, essentially, going on in these things.
Wow. We silk screened our own t-shirts.
There's some comics, I think, that people drew little...
What?
Yeah, one... panel comic things. Yeah.
Well, running's supposed to be fun, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. And when, you know, when it stops being fun, then you have to kind of question, why are you there? I mean, it's a type of thing where people couldn't pay you to do it. You might as well have a good time if they're not paying you.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell from the newsletters you guys had a good time.
Oh, yeah. Well, we still do.
Yeah.
We still do, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what was the place that you guys, there's a restaurant that you guys met at. Now it's Billy's, I think, but what was it? Pastime or?
Oh, yeah, up at Jean Duluth Road. Yeah, yeah, that was the first couple years they had John Berger's sled dog race.
Right, yeah.
They'd start at Ordean High School. Well, now it's East, I guess.
Yep.
And it would go up the roads and the back trails and so on and so forth up to Jean Duluth Road. It was called the Idle Hour.
Idle Hour. At the time. It's called the Idle Hour.
And we would run after the last dogs took off. We would run on the trail behind the dogs up to the Idle Hour, and then, you know, that was the first leg, the first, you know, check spot.
Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes we passed a team or two, but yeah. Not that much. And one of the years, I think Brian Landstrom was in the group. Brian Landstrom and Gary and Marcia Doty and Jeff Potts and a few other people. We all ran up after the dogs. Yeah. It was a great way to, you know, kind of be part of the celebration. We didn't get in the way again. You know, no one gave us any grief like, oh, you can't be here. You know.
Right, but, right.
And we, you know, so again, it was part of being able to join in the celebration without getting in the way of the celebration.
Yeah, fun. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Cool. Did you have a musher for the human dog team, the human sled dog team?
No, but boy, that hot chocolate sure tasted good when we're done.
Do the dogs get hot chocolate too, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe not. I'm curious with some of the stories about the early trail systems in conjunction with the city of Duluth and what the story is from your perspective of the Superior Hiking Trail development through the city.
Well, it's, and you know, again, looking at, you know, what it is in retrospect, it needed to be done. It was time to do it. They tied together a lot of trails to give you a destination rather than just a circle running around, you know, in circles, but it actually brought you places. And the sighting of it was, I woke up one day and it's like, oh, this is the route. And I was like, geez, that's interesting. I've been working on trails for about 20 years and no one, you know, checked in with me or with Jaro or anybody else that kind of knows the trails. It was kind of like this government agency that descended on us, which I guess that's some way how it has to be done. Because, again, it's not just the facility, it's the fundraising and the organization and the salaries that have to be paid and all that other stuff. And I don't get that stuff. I just want to go out and hike and work on the trail. I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a business, then it's only going to be for the people with money. And, you know, and the money is in kind of short supply, and human energy and human enthusiasm is limitless.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, the Superior Hiking Trail, they're doing a good job of maintaining. And, you know, again, it's interesting that, you know, to become a volunteer, they have a waiting list. And a lot of people that are volunteering for it don't live adjacent to the trail. So they come up, you know, once or twice a year, and they end up hiring out people to do their work for them.
Yeah.
And there's people that are living in the neighborhood that would be able to do the work for nothing that are there that could keep an eye on it every week.
Every week, every day. Yeah.
But there's kind of this cachet of being part of a bigger organization where, again, it's got more glamour to it than like, oh God, I got to go out. It's raining out. I got to see where the drainage is going. And then it gets soaked and it's, but I'm going to get out there and fix it before the damage happens rather than 3 months from now, someone that lives down in Rochester is going to come up and look at the trail and go, what happened here? Oh, God, now we got to spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, again, timeliness is so important.
Right.
And that kind of goes back, too, with the NMTC, their earlier runs when we were running in those horrible conditions. It made us aware of what trail work needed to be done.
Sure.
You have to go out in the bad conditions to see what's handling.
Right.
Good conditions, the trail's in great shape.
Right.
But
you wouldn't know.
You got to go out in the bad conditions.
The muddiest of the.
Yeah, and again, try not to do more damage, but at least assess what needs to be done and then do it. Don't wait for someone to do it.
Yeah.
Waiting takes too long. The 2012 flood. We came through Duluth. We had basically wiped out the Chester Trail.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And
wow.
I had the time, and the.
You were out of town when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I just that day, but I came home. Right. And, oh my God.
Yeah.
And within 3 weeks, the trail was very hikeable.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
And of course, we chiseled away at it. Well, the way the agencies run, City of Duluth went through FEMA to have trail damage assessed, and they assessed it with people from West Virginia and Idaho and Ohio, and they basically awarded $77,000 to repair Chester Creek Hiking Trail. Well, by then I had repaired it.
Yeah.
But then, this is in 2012, they got that grant. In 2016, they still had to spend the grant because, oh my God, we got this money and we have to do something. So they came out and they did trail work where the trail wasn't damaged. And I spent half the summer correcting the damage that the constructors did because they came in with equipment and they had no experience of the trail. They got the money and they're gone. They weren't even from in town.
Yeah.
So there was that going on. Plus the time that $77,000 was to be applied to the trail, the administration of the city had used up 60,000 of it. So there is $17,000 left.
Yeah.
Which is basically 1/20 of the award money was actually used for the work.
Wow.
So when you ask people to do your work for you, that's the bargain you get. You get 1/20 or one fifth of the work done that you paid for. If you did it yourself, you can get 100%.
Yeah.
So that's, again, it's just when people say it's not my responsibility or no one's going to stand in or we're going to do it and we authorize ourselves to be in charge. Well, then it's got a wide latitude for misuse or misapplication.
Yeah, or lack of value for yourself in the long run.
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, on the runs, you know, that go on in town, the Visitors and Convention Center is not really that involved with promoting the running in town. They are for grandmas. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong with grandmas. Oh, grandmas is great. You know, it's a focal point. But the legislature passed in the early days, the early 70s, a 1.5% sales tax for visitors and convention funds. And that's still in place, mostly for Spirit Mountain, which has still got financial problems. Mm-hmm. But that was to apply to all of the recreational and visitor stuff here. And the runners never really got anything besides grandmas.
Yeah.
And cross-country skiers never really got anything besides what was there. And the bike riders, of course, the bike riders have been successful about, you know, bringing their sport to the fore, but again, this was originally supposed to help them out, and since it didn't help them out, they had to arrange for their own system, and I think that's what's breaking down. Rather than unifying, we're dividing into our own little niches, and the niches are becoming kind of touchy to other uses, and I don't know. I when I went to kindergarten, I learned we had to share the sandbox. If you don't share the sandbox, then the sandbox isn't going to be there. So,
yeah.
You know, who's taking care of the sandbox?
Yeah. 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 I agree with the
everyone.
It's kind of a lot of a this user group versus that user group thing. And it's, I think people are a little bit aware of it. I think it's pretty good, but there's still a little bit of that kind of antagonistic feeling sometimes, I think, in people, and we need to phase it out as best we can.
Yeah, well, it's a very high school thing. It's you know, it's the jocks versus the theater group. You know, I mean, it's
right.
And they're always going to be somewhat antagonistic until they realize that they're in this together. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, we all do better if we all do better.
I think what's changed recently, and I think what's special is that, well, there's kind of three sandboxes in Duluth. You know, the mountain bikers have their trail, hikers and runners, foot traffic have their trail, and skiers have their trail, which is nice, but also there should be shared trails, right? I mean,
it's public land.
It's public land.
It's public land. Right, right. And you know, if you have a group taking over public land, then they have responsibilities and liabilities to meet. And one of the things is when you have a public facility, there's three basic legal representations of that property. One is permitted use, that you can use it, it's okay, you're on your own, you recognize the dangers, mm-hmm. you're responsible. The second one is no trespassing. Basically, you can't do anything here. It's we won't, you know, you can't have that. And then the third one is a license for specific use, which means that you have to maintain a safe operation for that activity. And this is where the skiers kind of, you know, oh, we got to make sure that no one's going to slip and fall and hurt themselves because someone walked in the track.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yet that's part of skiing is you fall, even if there isn't a mark in the track. And
right.
Again, to try to externalize the blame off someone else rather than your own caution is not honest. It's like, hey, comes with the territory. Every now and then you're going to have to cross someone's footprint.
Right.
Yeah. And again, if you're sharing the bike trails with runners, eventually one of the other is going to have to step to the side and let the other one go by.
Right.
And say, "Hi, nice to see you."
Exactly.
Yeah. Rather than get the hell off my trail.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that doesn't make friends.
Right.
So again, it's, you know, recognize people and wish them well, but don't let them tell you that you're ruining their day.
That's
their problem, not yours.
Yeah. The ski thing really, I scratch my head on it with sometimes the skier on a ski trail, on a groomed ski trail, especially a wide skate lane off to the edge, you should be able to snowshoe on that, because a snowshoe does zero damage to that, because that snow is already all scuffed up from the poles, from the edges of the skis. The skis and the poles do more damage than a snowshoe would to the damage, quote unquote, to the trail. Now, definitely don't walk in the groomed classic tracks. Stay out of those because for that reason. But the edge of a skate trail, you'd never know. If you could snowshoe on that, nobody would even know you were on it. But no, if you do, you're going to get yelled at for sure.
Well, you speak common sense, and again, common courtesy. You don't walk down the middle of the trail
Get
the set tracks.
Yeah.
But this is the same thing if you're walking the streets, like I have to do to get places. I don't walk down the middle of the street.
Right.
That's suicide. I don't walk on the freeway. That's too fast for me.
Right.
I'll walk on a nice shoveled sidewalk, and if it's not a nice shoveled sidewalk, well, I might have to walk to the edge of the road.
On the edge of the road sometimes. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the roads, you know, originally were shared use. People used to play in them. They used to run in them. You used to be able to sit on your porch and keep in track with your neighborhood.
Right. Horse-drawn carriage goes right down.
Stickball in the cities.
Kids are playing in the street all the time. And there's a really interesting group called Street Reclaiming that deals with reclaiming your neighborhood streets. Where, you know, I'd love to have you drive in my neighborhood. That means driving slow, taking your time, seeing what's there, saying hi to people, and all that stuff. I don't want you driving through my neighborhood when you're driving through to get to work because you're late and you're in a hurry, and you don't live there.
So
why slow down? You don't live there. Your kids aren't out on the street. Your dogs aren't out on the street.
Right.
And, you know, this is what a lot of urban planning, where it goes wrong when we have things centralized downtown. Right now, the majority of the people that are working in the the hospitals, the health industries don't live there. They live in Hermantown or in Rice Lake. They have to drive through my neighborhood to get to work. And these are busy people, so they're in a hurry. They're not looking where they're going.
Right.
And they're going through my neighborhood. And, you know, it to me is a failure of city planning that they didn't put the hospitals on the suburbs where there's plenty of open land, plenty of parking, plus it's closer to where their employees live. They're encouraging more carbon use, more carbon dioxide use by having it downtown away from their workers.
Right.
And, you know, engineering your life so that you can get by without a car. You learn that you want things close by, and any time you have to drive is kind of wasted time and wasted resources. So, you know, let's get back to, you know, basically being able to walk as much as you can. And besides, you get to meet people that way.
Yeah.
When you're in a metal box, you don't really, the metal boxes make people kind of angry.
It reminds me of, I can't remember if I've spoken about this before or not in the podcast, but in the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which you've probably read, I'm guessing, there's a part where he talks about, because he's taking a long motorcycle trip from Minnesota over to the West Coast, and he's saying on a motorcycle, you're much more aware of what's going on around you because you're literally in the environment, you're in the atmosphere, the wind's going through, you've got nothing blocking your vision. When you're in a car, you're essentially in your living room, you're inside of a metal block, looking out at a the windscreen, looking at a screen, basically looking at a large kind of TV sort of thing. It's kind of like the exact same thing as being in the house. You're not in the environment at all.
Yeah.
Well, this has its implications too with our online world and stuff too.
Yeah.
That what we see online is projected at us, and when something is thrown at you or projected at you, you have a fight or flight response, which makes you ideal for a solution like advertising, a new product, what have you. Natural lighting in the natural world, where there's no surroundings around you, again, if you're on a motorcycle or walking or running, the light is not projected at you, it's backlit.
And it
does things, better things for your brain to have things backlit, and also to have varying degrees of brightness, not bright all the time.
Right.
And we're losing the ability, we're losing our night vision. And I think our common sense too, because boy, when you walk in town at night, I used to have to walk to work at about 3 a.m. There's all these lights on. My God, the city's, I mean, who needs Bentleyville? Just the street lights. There's more damn street. Nobody's outside.
Yeah.
And why are we doing? Oh, it's for safety reasons. Okay, now consider, what's the safety reason? So you can drive faster, or you can see your victim up ahead,
right?
Or the power company needs to have a base load for their off hours, so they continue to make money.
Right.
And since it's a public load, the bill is always paid. They don't have to worry about the city paying their bill. They pay their bill. You and me, they'll track us down. The city, they don't have to track down. They just crank it out. And again, put up another light. Put up another light. They don't ever take them down.
Yeah. I just was reading about light pollution just not too long ago. It was interesting. It never really occurred to me how much there is and how we don't need, like you just said, we don't need all these lights. And then there's, you know, environmental aspects with nature, with birds and things like that too, and how it has negative impacts on them sometimes too. So,
from a commuting standpoint, if one of our listeners out there has never run into work or run to commute or even walk or bike, what would you tell them as a reason to do it or how to get started? What's your advice?
Well, don't say you can't do it. Start off with maybe sections of it, and maybe arrange to have one of your coworkers meet you halfway, or have them drive you halfway, and you make the rest of the way on your own, or mix it up with walking.
Yeah.
and bike riding too. I mean, biking, you know, I don't ride my bikes on trails because I think it cheapens both the trail and the biking experience itself.
Sure.
Bikes belong on the roads. They're a vehicle.
Yeah, right.
The first paved roads were for bicycles, not for cars.
Hmm.
It goes back in history. Again, that street reclaiming gives you the history of biking.
Yeah.
It was the American wheelman of that started the paving craze. So blame the bikers. But operate your bike as you would a car, a vehicle. Stop at stop signs.
Mm-hmm.
Ride in the proper lane.
Yeah.
Signal your intentions.
Yeah.
Get into the left lane if you're going to turn left across traffic, but signal.
Yeah.
People will say, oh, that's why they're in the middle of the road. They'll go around you and they'll be happy because they can get by you without worrying about your intention. But if you don't let them know that, they get pissed.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, once again, you know, you have responsibilities that go along with your privileges.
Do you think, Dan, that bikes on the road should also then be licensed just like a car?
It wouldn't be a bad idea.
Since they're utilizing the roads, public funds to support the roads.
It wouldn't be a bad idea
yeah.
from the standpoint of then at least you know how many bikes you have on the road.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to be counted. The bikes do not need a separate bike path or bike lane.
Yeah.
They need clean and repaired shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Cars benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the road does too. If you widen out the shoulder, the road lasts longer.
That's true. That's true. And there is a certain point, though, when the road gets too wide, it speeds up traffic.
Yes, absolutely. The lanes, they can shrink down the lanes, mm-hmm. but a good wide shoulder will make a road last longer.
Yeah. So again, street reclaiming, you got to look into it. It shows you how to slow down traffic, but also how to expand traffic.
You know, with the bike lanes being on 4th Street like they are, I don't ride, but when I do ride on the roads, I like to avoid traffic as much as possible. I would have wanted the bike lanes on 1st or 2nd, where you've only got traffic coming at you one way. There's fewer cars. 4th Street's busy, and then you get cars parked on both sides. And now in the wintertime, the road shrinks down because the cars can only park so far in, and then the bike lane's all covered anyway. I don't know. To me, I would have put the bike lanes on a different street than 4th Street.
Why is 4th Street a parking lot?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that's urban planning. And once again, that's mistakes have been made that it's too late to correct them.
So too late, yeah.
That's kind of the thing you get into. And I agree with you, Tony. I mean, the best bike routes are the ones that are less traveled.
Or less cars, yeah.
But sometimes you have no choice.
Yeah, exactly.
For years, they did not plow the Bong Bridge in the wintertime.
Really?
It was the only way to Superior on a bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
And Superior did their side. They plowed their side. Minnesota side, uh-uh.
What?
Wouldn't do it. And at the end of the season, you have really deep snowbanks, plus all the sand and grit. It's about 1.5 feet deep. And finally, they realize, oh, maybe we should be keeping this open for the wintertime so bikers can ride, you know, from city to city in the wintertime. And now they're maintaining it.
Hmm.
Huh.
But again, it was, you know, at the time that the bike lane was put in, originally the bridge had no bike lane on the side.
Okay.
Until Dennis Slave from Twin Ports Cycling went to the transportation meeting and said, hey, how come we have no way to get to Superior on our bicycles? He said, oh, you have a way to get to Superior. You can take the railroad bridge down in Oliver,
which is
that's, you know, you're doing a 20-mile round trip just to get to the bridge.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was able to convince the highway planners that, oh, well, maybe we should put in this extra bike lane, and that's why it's out on the edge the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also pretty narrow.
It is. It's two bikes meeting.
Which is the same problem with the lake walk. The lake walk is, particularly if they have the wide tourist rental bikes, it's dangerous. I would rather ride on Superior Street than ride on the lake walk. And that brings up another point about 4th Street. 4th Street is a commercial street.
Yeah.
And so is Superior Street.
Mm-hmm.
To make bicycles real, you've got to be able to get to businesses on your bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And if you ghettoize them and make them far away from the bike trails, you won't use your bike for your daily use. Hmm. Instead, it'll be just a weekend pleasure or event thing, mm-hmm. not a daily habit, a daily use. So again, you know, what Mike's suggestion of how do we get people to run to work or to bike ride to work? Start out small. Eventually, you find out that, hey, you can do this. And pretty soon, you find out that your commute's the best part of your day.
Yeah, that's what I found out the more I did it. That it's the best part of my day, one, but also is like a special treat before and after. And I think it's so interesting, just the subtle shift, not so subtle shift of commuting in a car versus commuting human powered, mm-hmm. because you feel good when you get to work, or especially when you get home from work, whereas and you feel good doing it too. It's like, wow, I like riding my bike, I like running, walking, I'm outside, great, it's a beautiful day, or I had a great day at work or whatever. Well, when you're driving, it's like negative. Maybe that's just me, like I get the road rage when I'm driving. It's negative. It's a negative feeling, you know?
Well,
why?
Yeah. Well, again, you're closing yourself in. You're restricting yourself. You're not expanding yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the other thing, too, that I see so many people running with their iPods on, mm-hmm.
their headphones.
And why are they not listening to where they are? Why aren't they happy with where they are? Why do they have to be someplace else?
Right.
I mean, we're in this wonderful world, you know, why have to hide it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, just to, you know, to be more aware of where you are, which, you know, you got to do when you're running. You got to watch where your feet are going.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Everyone's got this big fear. Oh, you run on trails. Oh my God. Well, you're going to break your leg. You're going to trip and fall. Hey, you know, you're much safer than running on the roads or the sidewalks where you expect it to be flat and all of a sudden it's not. At least with the trails, you're watching, you're aware of your surroundings.
It happens a lot when it gets more technical. You actually get injured almost less because you're focused. Mm-hmm. And then here you hear trail runners all the time, where did you trip? Oh, just in the middle of nowhere, it was completely flat. Where I tripped because you lost focus.
And it just takes a second. That's the deal, no matter how careful you are. So
I'm curious, we've had some friends of mine, we've had a discussion, speaking of lake walk and bikes and these new e-bikes. Because technically motorized vehicles are not allowed on the lake walk, and they are a motorized vehicle. They have an electric motor in them and they fly and they're quiet. And I know we're going to have some issues. If we haven't already, maybe we have. I don't know. But those
people go fast on those things.
They're really fast. They're far faster than a normal bike.
Yeah.
So I'm a little worried about those and what's going to happen with the future of those things.
I share your trepidation. And also on trails. They're on the trails, too.
They're
motorized vehicles on the trail, which will be more abrasive to the trail.
Yeah.
But this is the thing with technology. It's a new technology. It's always developed and used initially for the most beneficial uses, and you don't know the downsides yet.
Exactly.
And we're finding out the downsides. So that involves engineering to correct your engineering problem.
Right. And I think they're great. It gets a lot of people who maybe aren't going to be biking or is active. It gets them out there to be a little more active. It's opened up some more people to do stuff outside. That's a great thing. There's that positive aspect to them.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we've thought about some of the negative aspects, and we're going to start to see those.
Yeah, and again, it's a new technology. We're still discovering what's going on with them. And again, the technological costs of lithium cobalt batteries is basically keeping the Congo in warfare. And it's also for people that can afford the bikes. And the people that could benefit most from bikes are low-income people.
True.
So it's not just an expensive toy, it's a necessity. So again, not to trivialize bikes, but to use bikes for what they're meant to be is a useful tool, not a toy. The electric bikes, well, you know, like everything else, it's on a curve, it's rising and falling. You know, again, even our sport with running, you know, it has its ups and downs.
Yep.
And, you know, right now I think it's in pretty good shape, but, you know, for a number of years it wasn't doing so good. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's it remains to be seen, you know, how and where we go.
Speaking, Dan, of where we go, what's the future lie? What's your future? What lies ahead for Dan, Dan Proctor? In the running world, in the trail world, in the Chester Bowl world?
I hope to live a long and happy life. I might as well start now. I will continue to work on Chester Creek's hiking trail until I fall over.
Okay.
But I would like
to
have...
That's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that.
I would like to have someone eventually pick it up and realize it's not rocket science. It's just go out and do stuff when you see it needs to be done and don't make it difficult. I hope to continue. I might, you know, run again a little bit, but I'm not in a real pressure to do it. And I'll definitely be way at the back of the pack again, because that's where I belong. And actually, that's what the original NMTC, we started out a lot of the cross-country runs. It was common courtesy for the people that finished early to wait till the last finisher came in and made them feel like they've done something.
Yeah.
So that's important, is to recognize people that are coming along. They're not there yet.
Yeah.
But support them.
Yeah. I'm reading Scott Jurek's book, and he talks about that, and it came... He used to do that at races, and people were like, wow, that's cool that he does that, and he learned it at NMTC.
Yep, that's
no
right.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's there's that, and I hope to never have a car, which, you know, it's never is a pretty big word, but, right. You know, again, that's if I keep my health, and the house is paid for. I can't imagine moving any place where things are farther away, so.
Yeah.
I can't get closer to the park.
You're in a good locale, actually. Yeah.
So, yeah, again, just that sort of thing. And again, I just hope to keep going. I hope to keep having friends like you guys. And, you know, I got to go out and tell you guys to run faster, too. So.
Yeah, we're trying.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always good to see Mike out on the trail running with his dogs.
Yeah.
Again, he's always got the time to say hi, you know, which, again, this is goes back to, you know, you're not in a metal box.
Right.
You can actually say hi to people. And
you know, it's funny. I think about that all the time. I'm out running. I'll run on Vermilion or wherever, and I'll see, you know, just one car. It's just me and this one car. And I grew up in Farmville, Iowa, so you just wait. You know everybody, for one, but you just waved everybody. So I waved every car.
Yep.
Nobody waves back. Nobody. 1 in 20 maybe wave back.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why can't you just wave? I know you don't know me, but how about hello, fellow human, as we travel on this earth together? You know, why don't people just wave? I don't get that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good point. Wave. Yeah, you're from Iowa. The one finger on the steering wheel wave.
And if you really know him, it'd be maybe two or three fingers. Yeah.
But you don't let go of the steering wheel.
But you don't let go of the steering wheel. Just one quick. Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly the farmer wave.
Yeah. That's funny. That was the way too. I used to, you know, do tours with my bike through the state on the county roads and stuff like that. And again, farm country, everyone's friendly. Everyone waves.
Yeah.
You get close to a big city, and everyone just forgets how to acknowledge you.
Acknowledge the fellow human. So we're all kind of pursuing the same things together: life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
So again, that's the big thing. We got to share what we got. We have a lot. We have enough for everybody.
I have, speaking of that a little bit, and we alluded to it a little bit on the trails, I have noticed a little bit more, better, like, I'm running on the trails. I go to Hartley a lot. Most people I see nowadays are fat biking, especially now, this time of the year, they're fat biking. I almost always step off of the fat bikers because it's hard for them. It's way easier for me to just stop and restart again. It's harder for them. But there's a lot of more friendly attitudes now, you know, just me. Good to see you guys. Have a good day. Good ride. You know, two more behind me, that kind of thing. Everybody does that nowadays, that I can tell. So that's good.
And then they pick up on that, too. They go, hey, there's that friendly runner.
Right.
Yeah, I remember him.
Not all runners are jerks, or not all bikers are jerks. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true.
So it's reciprocal.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Pay it forward.
Pay it forward. Almost. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Is this your first podcast that you've ever been on?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I'm a Luddite. I don't have a computer. I don't have an answering machine. It's life is easy in the Stone Age.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, we can report back to you on the metrics from the internet.
Woo! Right. Yeah.
How many likes we get.
My IP, quick stop, whatever you want to, all these. See, I can't even speak the language. I listen to these ads on the radio for all these computer support services. Man, it's a different language. It's
right. Yeah.
We'll email you how many likes we get, how many listens we get. I'll just email you the report.
Thank you. Yeah, right. Good luck.
Yeah, I'll fax it to you. Smoke signals.
No, you gotta keep Mike the Mailman coming. You like stamps.
Well, thanks again, Dan. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, and then that wraps up the 45th edition of the Duluth Rundown podcast. Big thanks to our guest, Dan Proctor. It's just awesome to talk with Dan and hear some of his stories. Could have him on for two or three more for sure. Big thanks to our sponsor, Austin Jarrow, supporting the local community for a long, long time as well. Thanks to you, Mike, for all your work. Hopefully we'll see everybody out there on the trails, maybe at some of the Duluth Trail Winter Trail Series stuff, or somewhere along the road.
Absolutely. Perfect time to get out for some winter running.
Yep.